I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Three of the six Baltimore police officers charged in Freddie Gray's fatal injury have now been tried. None has been convicted. When Officer Cesar Goodson was cleared last week, many in West Baltimore said they were angry, but not surprised. Even before the officers were indicted 14 months ago, the rallying cry was, "Justice for Freddie Gray." Where does the city stand in reaching for that goal? Are convictions the way to measure justice for Freddie Gray? If not, where should we be looking? What questions should we be asking? We'll talk to the dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, the senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church, and the outreach leader of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. What would justice look like on Midday after the news from NPR? Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Now that three Baltimore police officers have been tried for their actions related to the fatal injury of Freddie Gray, and none of the three convicted, we're going to use this hour to take stock of where Baltimore is in the quest for justice for Freddie Gray. On May 1st, 2015, when State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced the indictments of six officers, she told the city, especially its young people, that they had a stake in the trials to follow.
To the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America, I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
Is justice being delivered? Last Thursday, the driver of the police van in which Freddie Gray was injured, Officer Cesar Goodson, was acquitted of all charges, including second-degree depraved heart murder and manslaughter. Many people in the community said they were angry, but not surprised. Officer Edward Nero was found not guilty of lesser charges a month ago. The jury in Officer William Porter's trial failed to reach consensus in January. What should we be focusing on? What questions should we be asking about justice for Freddie Gray? Here with me in the studio are three gentlemen with insights about justice and community. Reverend S. Todd Yeary is senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church in West Baltimore. Pastor Yeary also heads the church's two community development corporations. Welcome to Midday.
Good to be with you, Sheila.
Very glad that you're here. Ray Kelly is director of community relations for the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. No Boundaries is an advocacy organization led by its residents that works to empower Central West Baltimore across boundaries of race, class, and neighborhood. Welcome, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
And Ronald Rice is dean of the University of Baltimore School of Law. He came to UB in 2012 after several years as assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Obama administration, and years before that as a top lawyer on Capitol Hill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Dean Weish, when the police trials were about to start late last year, you wrote a piece in the Baltimore Sun that was headlined, "What Constitutes Justice for Freddie Gray?" How would you answer that today?
I would say now, as I said then, that justice does not demand any particular verdict in a criminal prosecution. Instead, justice is a process. Justice means that attention must be paid when a healthy 25-year-old man dies in police custody. That's a tragedy. We need to make sure that all steps are taken to prevent that from happening again. So one step in the process is a criminal trial. Here we have a state's attorney who brought very aggressive charges and devoted significant resources to prosecuting these officers. We had a fair-minded judge who was looking at the evidence in individualized cases, and he has determined that the state did not meet its burden of proof as to these three officers. That doesn't mean that justice was not served. Rather, it was determined that these officers didn't meet the standard for conviction in these cases that we've seen so far. But at the same time, attention is being paid in many other ways. The Justice Department is investigating the Baltimore Police Department. The General Assembly of Maryland has enacted several bills designed to improve the criminal justice system and policing in Maryland, including Baltimore. And we need to follow through on those efforts, and make sure that we are doing everything possible to protect individuals in police custody.
And we're going to get
into those issues later in this hour, I hope, but I want to get your sense, Reverend Yeary, of how people in your community are reacting to last week's news.
Well, the reaction, it depends on who you talk to. I think there was already a deep sense of cynicism about the process of prosecuting, police officers. So a not guilty verdict for many people was not a surprise. I think there's a deep learning curve for folks in general about how the prosecution process actually works. And so there's some educating going on. There are also some more pressing needs. These trials are going to take time over a period of time, but there's still issues of housing, health care, joblessness that are still very deep and persistent in the communities. And the question really is for them, for their very survival, what is happening in those areas to help address those other pressing needs that are part of the sub-story to who Freddie Gray was. He was a poor kid, exposed to lead poisoning early on, who had a number of challenges tied to the environment in which he lived. Has that environment changed structurally and significantly? And is there a plan for it to occur? And if that's not the case, no matter what happens with these trials, you're still going to have an issue of justice to address.
Well, since you posed the question, let me ask you, has, in all of those areas that you just highlighted, have you seen change?
I've seen and heard conversation. What we don't yet have is a clear plan. What is the timeline? What are the issues that we're going to address, and how are we going to move forward? I think there are a lot of well-meaning, interested parties having dialogue right now. I think the size of this problem that's kind of gotten out of control is so overwhelming that there's a fear that they may not meet all of the expectations. And so the biggest challenge has been finding a place to start to build momentum so that over time you can address some of those deeply embedded issues.
It makes a lot of sense. Ray Kelly, how did last week's news hit you and folks you're in touch with?
So I have to agree with both gentlemen that in
that's not
our community, we weren't surprised. There is a lack of faith in the actual justice system. And I think it's important that when we speak of justice for Freddie Gray, we are encompassing all of the Freddie Grays that are still walking the streets of Baltimore City, where justice will not come from a verdict or a settlement or anything. Like, we have to actually change the policies, the practices, the actual systemic issues that created this situation, that justice will come when this isn't the situation where we live.
Well, let me ask you to address what Reverend Yeary addressed, which is, I don't know whether to be heartened when I hear him say that there's a widespread dialogue, there's a lot of talk going on of how to address these problems, the problems that you so eloquently say hit the Freddie Grays who are still walking with us. Is it good that there's a widespread dialogue, or is this talk that is a substitute for action? I mean, how does it look to you, Ray Kelly?
Well, there is a new dialogue. There's definitely more interest in actually changing it, but I agree with Dr. Yeary. There's a problem because of disinvestment and not really addressing for so many years that it's an overwhelming issue where we've, for years, fought for change on certain issues, and we create a change, and then you have supplemental funding issues or all these bureaucratic roadblocks where there needs to be a plan, like he says, where we have a schedule of implementation and we kind of know exactly how we're going to address it. So the conversations are happening, but they're happening for a long time. So I think now we're over a year. It's time for implementation and moving forward, where we can't get lost just in the judicial proceedings. We can't wait to see what the next verdict is. There are things that are happening right now, and as we speak, I think within the next week or two, we'll have a findings letter from the DOJ and
the Department of Justice. Yeah, yeah. I do want to talk about that. I want to tie up one loose end. By the way, let me remind listeners that that was Ray Kelly of No Boundaries that you were listening to. Pastor S. Todd Yeary of Douglas Memorial Baptist Church is here with me, and Ronald Weisch, Dean of the University of Baltimore School of Law. And you can be part of this conversation. How do you feel about the verdicts? Do you think that the verdicts are not the primary way we're going to see justice for Freddie Gray? Do you think we are on path to see justice for Freddie Gray? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Ron Weisch, I may be over-interpreting your tense, but I noticed you use the past tense in describing the indictments, the resources that the state's attorney had put in. There is talk that perhaps after the results so far that the indictments should be dropped or might be dropped.
I did not mean through the use of the past tense to prejudge what would happen with the remaining indictments.
Do you have any opinion about whether it would be a good thing to drop them or a better thing to continue them?
I think any prosecutor is going to look at the results in these three cases, the one hung jury and the two acquittals in bench trials, and reassess the evidence and the theories of the prosecution of the remaining three officers who haven't been tried and the one who was tried, but the case resulted in a hung jury. So there'll be a reassessment. I don't have a particular view of I can't express a view as to whether the remaining indictments should be dismissed because I don't know all the evidence. I don't know all the theories. Each individual officer is prosecuted under a unique theory and a unique set of facts, and it is for the prosecutors to decide if they still have a case.
You're nodding vigorously, Pastor Yeary.
Well, I rely heavily on my friend Dean Weisch and his legal insight. The reason I take a step back, and I don't have a particular opinion one way or the other. There was a particular role that each of the officers had in their encounter with Freddie Gray. We've not yet, from the community standpoint, gotten to the genesis of the encounter on that Sunday morning. We've dealt with the van driver, the initiation to pursue him, right? There's still been no conversation about whether or not this detention of Freddie Gray that led to the finding of a knife and an arrest was legal in the first place. We're dealing with the issue of the death of Freddie Gray and how he had been handled once he was put into custody. And so no one has really pushed this issue when they see Freddie Gray at around 8:15 on that Sunday morning and allegedly Freddie runs. What was, other than the running, the reasonable suspicion? And I think there are deeper policy issues when we start talking about neighborhoods that are labeled high crime, when the Supreme Court has said just the mere running from a police officer could be enough to establish reasonable suspicion for a pursuit and an investigatory stop. We've got to then deal with the larger structural issues. Why are these areas high crime areas? Is it because they're poor? Is it because of the racial mix? Is it because of a combination of the things? Is it because of the history of the encounters between the police department and the community? And how do we change this label? Are these labels permanently affixed to certain areas of the city that's always going to lend itself to these unfortunate encounters between police officers and the community? And so when we start looking at how this rolls out, there is the issue of the criminality or the alleged criminality of the actions of the officers. But flowing out of this are deeper policy issues about how do we treat certain communities in our city that leads to these kind of encounters and gets us in the situation where we find ourselves today.
We need to take a quick break. And Ray Kelly, I want to get your thoughts on exactly that. And I also want, when we come back, to talk about this review that the Justice Department is doing and what it might mean. You can be part of this conversation. What do you think the verdicts say about the state's efforts toward police reform, if anything? Do you think progress is being made? Do you think progress could be made? And if so, how? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Well, Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Ronald Weiss, Dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore, and Reverend S. Todd Yeary, Senior Pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church. We're talking about the trials, the police trials, in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray, and where the search for justice for Freddie Gray stands. Ray Kelly, we were talking just before the break about I had raised the question, and the other guests had weighed in on whether these trials are accomplishing anything at this point, whether it makes sense to you that they should continue.
So I wouldn't have a legal aspect of it, but as a advocate for police and community relations for so many years, I think from our point of view, it's important that they follow through and have the trials, because the exposure that what we've been fighting for years is getting, and the attention that is getting on a national level, is helping us through the rest of the process. Once again, I try not to get locked into this whole judicial process, because there are other aspects of actual policy and system.
But that's
change.
What I wanted to clarify. So even though you don't see the judicial process as the primary route that's getting to solutions you're trying to reach, you think it is an important support process?
I think it's important that the system, the judicial process, exposes its inefficiencies right now, where we see that even though the coroner ruled this a homicide, there's still no accountability because of the structure of the system. And I think going through these trials and perception of the people is showing other areas of deficiency in our bureaucracy and in our judicial system that needs to be addressed.
Don has called us from Annapolis with a question that relates to something that you raised, Dean Weiss. Don, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guests on the question of the system and how it's failed the community in Baltimore. How do Mr. Miller and Mr. Bush and Martin O'Malley and the Democratic Party, who have controlled Maryland for years, bear responsibility for the neglect of Baltimore?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the tail end of what you said. You're talking about Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker Mike Bush, but I didn't hear the very last thing you said you want them to account for.
Well, and former Governor O'Malley,
right.
How do they bear responsibility for the apparent neglect of Baltimore and the current state of the system?
Does someone want to address that, whether or not the state has fulfilled its obligations to Baltimore? Reverend Yeary.
This is the state capital S is the structure, and the actors within the structure all play a role. This is not a condition in Baltimore that was just birthed in what we would call recent memory. This is a condition that's been evolving in Baltimore City, in pockets in the city, for over a generation now. So we have to be really clear about that. We have to remember that, excuse me, allergy season. In the mid-90s, the largest employer in Baltimore City was Bethlehem Steel. 20 years later, it's Johns Hopkins. The economics of where do you find job access have changed. Is that an issue of the structure? Is it an issue of not being able to retool? What we know is that there are communities that have gotten left behind economically in this shift from what has been kind of a steel-driven economy to one that's based on eds and meds, so to speak. So how do you get folks re-engaged in an economic climate that's shifted by no fault of their own? And when we look at Carl Alexander's book, The Long Shadow, and the greatest predictor of where children are going to end up is what is the status of their parents, says to us that this is really not an issue of politics. It is an issue of persistence. And this persistence has lasted not just in Baltimore City, but in cities across the country that are facing similar issues. We are finding this to be a very pernicious issue that we're having to deal with. And it's only when you have a tragedy like a Freddie Gray, much like it was in the 60s with the Kerner Commission report. Why was there such a backlash in urban enclaves across the country when there was so much effort being put in making folks economically viable and participants in the process. So I think there are other issues that we have to look at beyond just who's in the seat.
Ron Weiss?
Yes, I'd like to pick up on an important point that Todd Yeary just made. This is not only a Baltimore problem. And so the caller asks, why has Baltimore been failed? But in fact, in urban centers around the country, there's this concern about the relationship between police departments and the community they serve. There are issues of over-incarceration and enforcement patterns and racial profiling. Baltimore became a symbol of these issues last April, but it's not the only city facing these issues. And in fact, in the months before and after Freddie Gray's death, we saw incidents in Staten Island, in New York, and in Chicago, and in Cincinnati and elsewhere that show that this is a national issue. And the Justice Department has been active in a number of cities, as it is now in Baltimore, to try to improve police procedures to strengthen relations between law enforcement and the community.
And let me, there are lots of things I want to pick up on, but since you've brought us back to the Justice Department, summarize for us what it is the Justice Department is doing, and then I want to get Ray Kelly's ideas about what it might mean for Baltimore. But what is this review?
The federal government has authority under the 1994 crime bill to investigate patterns and practices of police conduct. And the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, currently headed by Vinita Gupta, Assistant Attorney General, is responsible for investigating police practices. They look at, for example, recruitment of police officers. They look at training. They look at deployment. They look at supervision of line officers. And they look at disciplinary systems. And then make recommendations. And indeed, they are in a position to coerce some changes, to leverage some changes, because federal law may demand them. So that process is underway. And as Ray Kelly said, we're very soon going to see an investigative report, findings, that will commence the next stage of this process.
That is Ron Weiss, Dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here in the studio is Reverend S. Todd Yeary, Senior Pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church, and Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. We're taking your emails at midday@wypr.org and your calls at 410-662-8780. So, Ray Kelly, you have been, do I understand correctly, part of a citizens group that's been working with the Justice Department this review?
We've been open and we have transparency with the DOJ. So we created a community commission in West Baltimore, the West Baltimore Community Commission on police misconduct. And we, immediately after the unrest, we started taking testimony just so we could document resident reactions. So when the DOJ started their investigation, we were connected and we gave them access. Look, this is what we're going to do. And we've kind of liaised quite a few events where they could come in and actually talk to people. And we've just been investing in this tool that's going to be available to us and just try to make sure that as they go into the negotiations with the city, that the resident point of view, the people that actually voice these problems and live these issues, have influence on their recommendations.
You sound hopeful about this process, this Justice Department review. Do you think it's going to make changes?
Well, I feel like the system itself won't change unless it's forced to change. And like Ron said, this is pretty much it's a lawsuit being brought. If the process before, if they can reach a settlement, an agreement, then there won't be a lawsuit. And we just think that if they are forced to make these changes that have been talked about and problems have been discussed for years, then that could be the start of actual, like he said, implementation. So we can kind of craft a plan, because maybe the implementation process for the DOJ consent decree will be 5 years, so we'll have to have a schedule of implementation to follow to make it in that 5 years.
So it seems like more of a way forward to you than the police trials. the pressure that some people expected to come from the public airing of testimony and judgments by juries or a judge, which people now seem more disappointed in?
Well, I think it was two things. One, the trials deal with the encounter with Freddie Gray, right? So we gotta get resolution. Why did Freddie Gray die?
Mm-hmm.
And who's responsible? So that's one thing. But this death in custody being part of a larger systemic issue has to also be explored. So I think it's two prongs of the same fork. They're running parallel tracks, but they're actually somewhat independent of each other. Even if Freddie Gray were still alive, you would still have the need for a pattern or practice investigation. That was our contention when many of the community leaders met with the then newly sworn Attorney General. Remember, she comes to Baltimore City within a few days of having been sworn as the Attorney General to deal with this particular issue. It was the first thing on her plate.
I'm proud that we hosted that event at the University of Baltimore so that the community would have an opportunity to speak with the Attorney General.
So with the Attorney General coming in, I think you heard a number of voices. I think you heard the community saying, this is what we need. We need a set of eyes beyond the collaborative process that was already ongoing to see if there's a different level of scrutiny required to see what's going on inside the Baltimore City Police Department. The mayor also made that request, and at that point, her formal request is what initiated that process. And so I think we wait and see. But in the meantime, you still have a young man who died in police custody. And though you have a coroner's finding of homicide, right, death by, he didn't do it to himself. That much we know. What happened? And is there some criminal responsibility for what happened? And I think that's the issue that folks are having a hard time resolving. In the community, they've come to expect that if someone dies at another's hands, there is an ultimate price to be paid. What's happening in this instance with these officers, and why does it feel like there's a distinction? And I think that's where the learning about how the law actually works and applies when it comes to what law enforcement officers have great latitude to do when it affects the liberty of everyday citizens. We've got to understand that in a different way so that we can make that relationship healthier from an informed perspective.
Let's talk to Dave, who's calling us from Baltimore. Dave, welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you very much. And I think great topic, and you have some very insightful persons on the panel. I think progress can be made, and perhaps has in some minor ways, but I think leadership is absent. For example, where is the mayor's coordinating council on criminal justice? Where is the media? I see the best media treatment of the whole thing was the young man who took the video, because Freddie was obviously injured at the very beginning when they knelt on his back and then proceeded to kill him. The whole system is a lack of leadership or reflection to go any deeper, and you can predict nothing is going to happen unless it goes deeper, I think.
Dave, I appreciate your thoughts. I'm not sure that the testimony that I've read exactly matches your analysis of when the injury took place, but since I haven't been covering the testimony of the trial, I'm not going to debate that with you. Does anybody want to respond to Dave?
I would just note that there is new leadership in the police department, in the school system, and of course we had an election, a primary, and there'll be a general election, which will result in there being a new mayor, also a new members of the city council. So leadership is transforming over time.
But you know, when you raise that, I mean, we've had a primary, haven't had a general election yet. There's a lot of people have a pretty good assumption of who will be heading the city government after January, but it hadn't happened yet. And by the same token, we're waiting for this Department of Justice review, but it's not public yet. Is there sort of a sense of suspended animation? Are things not being addressed or changes not being made because we're waiting for these other pieces to fall into place?
No. Me personally, I just feel like this, we are in the midst of the change. The change was the quick indictment of actual police officers. This is not the norm in any of these urban communities where quickly police are actually brought to trial. And that the change, like this change in leadership, was prompted by protest and just intolerance of the way it's been going for decades. So we are in the midst of the change. We have these tools available to us, like the DOJ now, where we could actually influence the changes ourselves. And that's kind of where the No Boundaries Coalition kind of comes in, is we want to make sure that the people that are directly affected are the ones that are speaking on these issues, more so than the elected officials that are in office right now and who are actually on their way out. So these residents will still be here with the new elected officials and the officials that come after them. So these are the people should have stake in what's being pushed to the DOJ.
Yeah, to that point, Sheila, I think you raised a concern that many folks have had. Are we in this place of suspended animation waiting for another transition? And I will say that Commissioner Davis is seriously working hard to try to foster healthier relationships at the community level. I know that personally. I talk to him rather regularly from time to time. He'll sometimes reach out and just kind of bounce ideas. So I don't think that there's a waiting. I think there's some things you have to wait on in terms of the outcome before you overcommit. Are there things in the findings from the Department of Justice that will impact certain things around implementation and timeline? So how far do you go knowing that you've got a report coming? I think there are some things that the department's working on. The mayor, there's this term of being lame duck, right? So how seriously will anybody take the voice of an elected official that they think is on the way out? That's a conversation going on from the top all the way down. We've got an even number on the Supreme Court because of that very issue, right? So,
exactly.
So I think we have to be real careful about how much stake and stock we put into it. What opportunities do we have today to make progress? We're not going to resolve this before the next mayor takes seat, and probably many of the deeply embedded issues may not be resolved by the time their term of service, whatever that may be, is over. We're over a generation into this thing. It's not going to change overnight, but what can we do today with all vested parties engaged and on board to start building momentum to make Baltimore City better? And I think that's the question. It's not just a police question. Ray is with a community organization, so communities have to be engaged. Ron is in education, so the next generation of legal thinkers, the scholars who help us understand the application of law, how are they going to help move this forward? And clergy who deal with the hurts and the ills of folks that come through our doors but may not be members of our congregation, we deal with it every day. Everybody's, it's all hands on deck today, starting right now. We can't wait on a report and we can't wait on a transition. We've got to continue to deal with these issues right now.
We need to take another quick break here. Lots more to talk about, including the violence that is swirling all around Baltimore. Stay with us over this break. Join our conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about what justice looks like halfway through the police trials of the officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray. I'm speaking with Reverend S. Todd Yeary, senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church, with Ronald Weish, dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, and Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Florida. And one thing that crosses my mind as we're discussing this is, of course, it's not taking place in a vacuum. Homicides continue at high levels in Baltimore. Almost halfway through this year, there have been 133 homicides so far this year. That's a far cry from the 344 of last year, but still a very high number of homicides. On Saturday night, the rapper Lor Scooter was shot dead in his car. Ray Kelly, you've been looking quite closely at the pattern of homicides in the Western District. Talk to us about that.
And I think that's something that needs to be brought to attention, is the fact that through collaboration with community organizations, the police department, the merchants in the area, that Western District in 2014 only had 21 homicides, and that was the lowest in like 12 years. And following the riots and the unrest, 2015, we had 66 homicides, which is three times. So we have to kind of recognize the dynamic of what changed that, and we have to kind of look at what we were doing before. And like Dr. Yeri said, we can't just sit around and wait. We have to be doing everything we can. Like, we have to make sure we leave no T uncrossed and no I undotted where we registered the voters. There's a whole process to make sure we're bringing attention to what happens in the community and not one issue.
And what do you think was the primary difference in these numbers you cite of such a big surge? We saw a surge citywide, but you trace it quite specifically in your part of the city. What was working better in 2014 that then wasn't happening in 2015, and what's happening in 2016?
Well, I think in 2014, 2013, everyone was about visibility, collaboration. We were addressing that specific issue of the violence and the open-air drug trade in West Baltimore. And when the Freddie Gray incident happened, everybody focused on that one issue, and it became a focal point when we still have the systemic issues, the environmental issues in the community that have been plaguing us for years and what kind of leads up into a Freddie Gray incident. So we kind of have to get back to fighting for ourselves and doing everything we can, instead of, like Dr. Yeri said perfectly, waiting for something to happen or sitting on our laurels or whatever the case may be. We have to once again come back out and reclaim our communities.
Several hundred police officers left the department after Freddie Gray's death. I read in April, the Baltimore Sun reported, I think 271 officers had left, and there were at that point 284 vacancies in a department of about 2,800. It's something like 10% of the department was vacant. Is that a big part of the problem? Is that part of why we're seeing such violence?
There's always the question of how much policing balance is required in urban settings where criminality has a number of contributing factors to it. I remember my first ride-along in the Western District, that the officer I rode with, who was not a resident of Baltimore City but very committed, bemoaned the situation that the only way you could really kind of position yourself for promotion was not really based on service calls, but how many folks you actually placed in custody, how many arrests did you make. And if you weren't bringing in the arrests as demonstrating the tough-on-crime policing philosophy, you really didn't get a whole lot of collegial credibility. Now, that's anecdotal from someone, an officer I rode with. But if that's indicative of some of the culture that you're dealing with, you could have every police vacancy filled. And what you really have, and this is to the earlier caller's issue, and it's something we got to wrestle with, when it comes to the strategies of zero tolerance, and does that create a framework where now you're over-policing in areas instead of building a relationship in areas, and how long does it take you to disentangle from that? And that was not just for a particular personal administration. Remember, that was a national policy that had gone on for years. Three strikes was the new trend. And when that begins to translate as adversely impacting some communities over and against other communities, you create for yourself this trick bag that now you're trying to figure out your way out of. So do we need more policing, or do we need more good policing? That's the question. And I'm not sure that's a number that we're after. It's actually a relationship and a condition we're looking for.
Ray, you're nodding your head vigorously.
Because we had this conversation and Dean Ward's class, where we talked about community policing has to be viewed as a tactic instead of a solution, because the more affluent and lower crime communities don't necessarily need to be police. A patrol is more than sufficient. So we have to kind of make sure we're not looking for this solution, but once again, we're using this community policing model as a tool to get the community to be where it has to be and patrol, where I think community comes after this model leaves. The community will police itself, and we won't need a department to police us.
And I would just add that there is no contradiction between respectful policing and effective policing. That's the history of police reform in this country, and the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division has been very effective in fostering a culture, as Reverend Yeary says, of respectful policing, community-oriented policing. And in communities where that has taken hold, crime goes down.
Reverend Yeary, a few minutes ago, I certainly wouldn't try to quickly quote someone as eloquent as you without actually having the words in front of me, but you said something about the expectation in the community that when someone dies at another's hands, someone will be punished. But so many crimes and homicides in particular are going unsolved in Baltimore. That is that expectation of justice, not just in the particulars of Freddie Gray case, but that expectation by the community that people who do wrong will be brought to justice. Is that alive and well?
I think it's an aspirational mindset that's hard to put into practice into neighborhoods where the retribution of speaking out about violent crime is very real. And when you're not really sure that if you take the risk to talk about who the perps are with the police department, can the police department keep you safe? Then at the same time, you have to, in some of these communities, feel like you have to protect yourself against the police themselves. So are you really, who do you talk to? And so many times the paralysis of just great intimidation and fear is so real that I think sometimes we underestimate just how serious a problem it can be. And I think you're seeing it play out in terms of the types of violence we're seeing on the streets. You've got illegal guns running in and out of Baltimore City at levels that are really kind of hard to track. I know it's one of the deepest issues that you've got. So now you have all kinds of contributing factors. You have the reemergence of the drug trade in some of the communities. You've got turf wars. You've got just all kinds. And you add to it high unemployment, lack of education, lack of access, all of those things that the paths to getting folks on a track that takes them out of that cycle seem not to be available. I think you've got the perfect storm for the types of conditions we're seeing not only in Baltimore, but if we look at how it's playing out in urban enclaves across the country, you're seeing similar sets of contributing circumstances that are leading these cities in tough directions.
Ron?
That's right. The surge in violence is not only in Baltimore. We've seen it in Chicago and elsewhere. Washington, D.C. has had an uptick in homicides. I want to make a point, though. Reverend Yeary says, you know, people expect there's been a death. Someone's going to pay for it. And in general, that's right. There should be accountability and sometimes criminal accountability. But we should not feel that because no police officer has been convicted of a crime yet in connection with Freddie Gray's death, that somehow justice has not been served. There is a necessity for an individualized determination. Each of these officers is being tried separately so that the judge can consider whether his or her actions constituted a crime. And just as Freddie Gray and others in West Baltimore deserve to be treated as individuals and not based on generalizations or stereotypes or a mob mentality, these officers deserve the same constitutional rights and courtesies and consideration in the criminal justice system. We should be proud that the criminal justice system is treating these officers as individuals, and we should strive to have that kind of individualized justice throughout the system and in West Baltimore.
I don't argue with you, but that's got to be a hard lesson in parts of West Baltimore, is it not?
I'm not sure.
That we should rejoice in the fact that the system is working, that that...
I think rejoice is a little strong. Let's start with the cynicism of the very first trial of Officer Porter. Remember, there was great concern nationally that the bias of the communities of Baltimore City would not allow you to seat a jury that would objectively hear the evidence and come to some conclusion. And so we were already under a new level of scrutiny over and against the backdrop of the media specter of the disturbances. The fact that you were able to seat a jury, granted the jury did not reach a decision, but you were able to get 12 people in the box to say, I'll hear it objectively, and we'll apply law to facts to try to reach an outcome, I think is a huge deal for a city that many folks had very, very low expectations for. Now, the other officer's tactical determination to go with bench trials is one that they're entitled to. I think no one could argue with Judge Williams' very clear and methodical approach to handling the evidence in the trials as comes up in his rulings. I think what we're finding out is there's clearly a difference in terminology. Words have meanings. There's what happened, and then there's what you can prove. Mm-hmm. And so not guilty means that you did not meet your burden of proof. Mm-hmm. It does not mean that what you allege happened didn't happen. And so we've got to come away, and I think the community has to reconcile the fact that not guilty is an outcome of a process that everyone's entitled to, and that's part of the justice equation, but it still does not erase away that Freddie Gray did, unequivocally and without any doubt, sustain injuries that took his life while he was in police custody, and there are other avenues that we have to address to be able to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
We have just a couple minutes left. Ray Kelly, what gives you hope at
this
moment?
I definitely don't feel like we should rejoice. That's a big word for me. But I definitely believe that we should utilize that exposure and in any way we can manipulate any momentum that comes from it towards the actual policy changes. I think what gives me hope is there is a community presence now that is actually involved and engaged in the process, not just the demonstration where I'm seeing in my community many people taking the step to go from protest to policy, where they are in these meetings with police department. There's community mediation going on with post officers and actual residents, where that's a big change. That never happened, where they sit in the same room and they actually humanize each other. So we have to take every aspect of this and use it to our advantage for the change we want to see.
Ron Weiss, half a minute left.
I think we should be proud of our community. As Reverend Urey said, there was a jury that approached this matter in a serious, fair-minded way. We have a judge, a man who himself previously prosecuted police misconduct, weighed the evidence carefully, and issued clear, careful decisions. And then, as Ray Kelly says, we've turned protest to policy. And I come back to those bills that have passed the legislature, the Justice Reinvestment Act, which will improve criminal sentencing and other aspects of the criminal justice system, and at least the first step towards more accountability in police misconduct cases.
We have to leave it there. I'm grateful to you all. Ron Weiss, Dean of the University of Baltimore Law School, thank you.
Thank you.
Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore, thanks.
Thank you.
And Reverend S. Todd Urey, senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church.
Sheila, always good to be with you. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. As premiums and deductibles and prescription costs rise, we look at what's driving up healthcare costs across America. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.